Hello everyone, welcome back to the forum, where science comes to socialize. And let me tell you, we are going to be talking a lot about socializing today.
That's right, Aubrey, because today's topic of choice is exactly what we do every other Monday right here on the show. The name of the game is science communication,
also known as SciComm,
which is a hugely important movement that was debated at the Institute on Science for Global Policy's first ever science communication workshop back in August of 2015. This program was convened in cooperation with Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society.
So, in the spirit of science communication, or hashtag SciComm, it's basically your civic duty today to engage with our show on social media. Tweet us at ISGP Forum with the hashtag ISGP Forum, or post on our Facebook wall. And trust me, if you use the hashtag SciComm in your tweets as well, you'll have a large social media audience today.
That's because there is a whole community of science communicators out there, and they do a lot of work via the internet.
And one of those social media active science communicators is Liz Neely, the executive director of the Story Collider. Miss Neely was one of the presenters at ISGP's Communicating Science for Policy workshop in North Carolina. It's her paper and debate that we'll be discussing today.
To read Miss Neely's position paper titled Training in Narrative Persuasion for Ethical, Effective Science Communication, check out the Institute on Science for Global Policy's website under the Publications tab.
So to kick off this discussion, let's first clarify that the entire community of presenters, debaters, and audience members at this conference agreed that effective science communication tactics are 100% essential for enacting effective science-based policies.
The debaters felt that the public is actually put at risk when science communication is done poorly. Even when the communicator is disseminating accurate information, that might not be enough.
Right. Because when you're talking about polarizing topics, take climate change for instance, giving people more and more facts could actually harden their opposition to the message if their previously held opinion contrasts with the science, which we'll get into a little later on.
There are a lot of ways to communicate scientific information, and Ms. Neely's tactic of choice is storytelling.
Storytelling, according to the debaters, is one effective communication tactic. But there was quite a bit of contention regarding whether or not storytelling, also known as narrative persuasion, has a place in the hard sciences.
Especially because, as Ms. Neely states in her paper, hard scientists are trained to seek objectivity, deliver dense and jargony presentations, and appreciate numerical results. It begs the question, can science really be turned into a story that simultaneously captures the public's attention and conveys information authentically?
Well, let's take a step back and review some of the other methods currently used by science communicators. To give you an idea, and this is definitely not a comprehensive list, some science communicators use social media platforms like Twitter or Facebook, others are bloggers, and still more make YouTube channels or podcasts like this one.
And Ms. Neely reports that, according to the studies, the main goal of science communicators is to defend science, with education coming in at a close second.
Doesn't that make it seem like communicators are adopting a defensive attitude, as if they had to defend science against public naysayers and skeptics?
I think that's an accurate assessment, Barb, and it tends to coincide with scientists' perception that the public generally is uninterested in learning about science, that they're only motivated by sensational scientific information that directly impacts their everyday life.
Always bringing the hard-hitting truth, Aubrey.
Hey, I am just summarizing Ms. Neely's paper here.
I know, I'm just kidding.
But to go along with that, it's important to realize that studies show the public is more likely to act on a feeling or emotion than a hard scientific fact. And our presenter really wants to find a way for scientists to harness the power of emotion when conveying scientific information.
Right. And it's necessary to better comprehend value judgments when it comes to predicting or informing people's actions in response to new information, especially when that information is complex and scientific.
English, please.
It's necessary to understand what people value, as well as how those values influence actions.
Got it. And that's something that most scientists and even some science communicators fail to think about.
Is it a scientist's job, though, to figure out how to get the public's attention? I mean, is it fair to say, hey, scientist, go find a cure for cancer. And once you have, figure out how to explain that cure to people and get everyone to care about it.
Well, probably not the best example, since I think most people care about curing cancer. But I get your point. Scientists already have a lot on their plates.
Plus, you can't improve people's understanding of science by throwing more and more information at them. There is such a thing as information overload.
In other words, too much information might cause confusion regarding what to believe. But it can also cause closed-mindedness or opposition, even if the recipient of the information had no opinion prior to hearing the info.
Guys, I just realized that we are literally talking about talking today. How meta is that?
So meta.
I'm really glad this is an audio podcast, or else our audience would see me rolling my eyes and judging you two right now.
Well, now that we recognize all of these communication challenges, let's hear Ms. Neely's proposed solutions and what the debaters thought about them.
Okay, like we alluded to earlier, Ms. Neely's proposal is the use of narrative persuasion, which she defines as, and I quote, the use of stories to influence people's mental models, beliefs, and behaviors in the real world. She goes on to say that two concepts of interest arise from this definition.
The ethics of persuasion, and whether storytelling is a valid means of persuading people.
I remember from the debate that many disagreements among conference participants arose because of the word persuasion.
Definitely. In her position paper, Ms. Neely defines persuasion as, quote, convincing an audience to make a decision of his or her own free will, end quote. Thus, coercion and manipulation are major no-nos.
As is exaggerating details for dramatic effect. The world of narrative persuasion in science has zero tolerance for bending the facts.
Even so, some scientists at the debate table were deeply bothered by the very thought of even being associated with persuasion. From their perspective, a scientist's job is to present data and nothing more.
And when you're hoping to persuade, storytelling seems like a valid tool. After all, stories are a more effective tool for capturing an audience and sticking in someone's memory as opposed to evidence-based communication.
Listeners can relate to the characters in the stories, making empathy an important reason why storytelling is an effective communication strategy in general, whether or not you think it should be used in the sciences.
Right. Emotion is key.
Given all of these reasons why storytelling is a good teaching tool, did the debaters agree that it should be used by scientists? Well, there was definitely a dichotomy here. Some thought yes, while others weren't convinced.
Well, Ms. Neely says that we won't be able to consider using storytelling effectively if we don't figure out a way to teach the art of narrative persuasion to scientists.
Which could be a lot more complicated than just learning in a classroom. Storytelling is pretty nuanced. I mean, you have to master your language, your timing, and especially audience engagement.
And the right style of communication is highly dependent on the audience and the intention of the communicator.
Ms. Neely even suggests that improv theater and different types of visual arts training could help the cause. Could you imagine real-life Sheldon Coopers and Leonard Hofstadters in acting classes across the globe?
Bazinga! But, as someone who has done both theater and science her entire life, I can speak from experience and say it's totally doable.
In any case, storytelling formats that could be useful are wide-ranging and span from professors teaching in their lecture halls using the power of metaphor to Hollywood movies and TV shows. Well played on the Big Bang Theory references, guys.
Why, thank you.
There has to be some concrete communication guideline, though, regardless of the medium or format of dissemination.
Sure. You've got to lead with warmth and then tie in the science. Capture their attention by helping them establish a connection to the story, and then weave in the facts that are important to your cause.
But there was definitely some concern regarding the recommendation that scientists be trained as storytellers. Some debaters asked how you draw a line between persuasion and manipulation. Basically, they worried that scientists would inadvertently shift from being reporters to advocates.
And if that happened, there was a fear that scientific credibility would go down the drain.
Speaking of scientific credibility, it's worth mentioning that many scientists feel that the public in general doesn't trust science.
And people are going to continue making decisions based on whom they trust to disseminate information, whether or not those people are scientists. Accordingly, Ms. Neely thinks that storytelling can be used to improve the public's trust in science.
I suppose that using stories would at least make scientists seem more relatable. That should help with the trust issue.
Well, some debaters felt that humanizing the scientists and having them talk about themselves in addition to their data is really outside the realm of science.
Well, scientists aren't robots.
I might be a robot.
Scientists beside Aubrey aren't robots.
Okay. You guys are so weird. But it's true that if scientists tell stories, they would at least in some cases become characters, or at least voices or personalities. This is something that would be very strange and new to the scientific community.
And that made the debaters question whether it would be dangerous for individual scientists to take on a communicative role.
Why would that be problematic?
Well, the way that science dissemination to the public currently works is that the distributed information represents a unified voice of scientific consensus. In other words, when you hear a news report on a scientific breakthrough, that report reflects the general agreement of the scientific community.
Ah, I see. So if you have individual scientists communicating on their own, you lose that sense of unified agreement.
Exactly.
So this all has to do with gaining and maintaining public trust. But I think some scientists' first priority would be gaining the respect of their colleagues in the scientific community. And the current state of academia makes public science communication a risky business.
That is so true. It was noted that academic institutions are often reluctant to include science outreach, say, blogging, podcasting, or what have you, in their tenure decisions. And when scientists leave the research bench to pursue SciComm, they're almost looked at as traitors.
Wait. To be fair, it was noted that some institutions are starting to ask tenure candidates what they've done to engage the community recently.
Point taken.
Either way, Ms. Neely clearly thought that this perceived traitorism is so much of an issue that she called for incentives to promote science communication in her position paper.
For example, she said that universities and other agencies could develop grant programs that facilitate the development of better communication skills. And, of course, she advocated for amending the tenure and promotion criteria to reflect outreach activities.
But I wonder whether dissemination of scientific info via blogs and other freelance sources would result in a lack of quality control. What I mean is, how could we assure that bloggers are reporting credible information?
The debaters definitely agreed that if we advocate scientific storytelling, accuracy must never be compromised. Precision, on the other hand, might be lost in some cases, which wasn't as big a concern.
And this leads to a question of acceptable practices. There was discussion between Ms. Neely and the debaters about forming networks of trained storytelling practitioners, if you will, people who could develop best practices and ensure that those practices are both understood and used in real-world SciComm.
On another note, we know that the scientific community relies heavily on the peer review process, but Ms. Neely pointed out during the debate that blogs kind of already have a built-in review system in the form of comments. She said that sometimes she even sees more insightful commentary on blogs than in letters published in scientific journals, and the comments are exchanged faster on blogs too.
And presumably, the quality of these informal science communication avenues would improve if training for science communication was improved.
Despite the fact that some conference participants were unsure about the use of narrative persuasion in the sciences, it was agreed that general science communication training should be incorporated into education formally.
But that would raise so many questions. What would the training include? And geez, at what age or educational level should we start schooling at? Is K through 12 too soon? Is grad school too late?
And while we're at it, we might as well teach people how to better identify credible scientific information.
Exactly.
It sounds like the debaters are calling for a lot of significant institutional changes here. I mean, think about it. Change the culture of the scientific community to embrace narratives, change tenure track guidelines, change education curricula.
You're right, Cleo, and it's daunting. I think that's the reason why some debaters suggested that we teach science to storytellers instead of teaching storytelling to the scientists.
This can definitely be done, and there's something to be said for looking to SciComm legends like Bill Nye for pointers when figuring out how to engage a non-scientific audience. But having more Bill Nyes would probably be good for the scientific community.
Time to invent a cloning machine.
Oh, wait, we already have one. We're just waiting for Mr. Nye to return our messages.
And for the world's necktie factories to make enough bow ties to keep up with the sudden increase in demand.
Ah, gotcha.
Anyway, Ms. Neely did suggest that interdisciplinary collaborations between scientists and non-scientist communicators be established.
Doesn't this happen sometimes already?
Well, our presenter clarified that, when it does, the partnership typically forms after the research is done. If the partnership is instead forged at the beginning of a research project, then the two parties can learn from each other throughout the research and reporting process.
But regardless of who is actually doing the communicating, something that needs to be addressed is how in the world we should be communicating uncertainty.
You're right. That's a really important point. Science is, after all, wrapped in uncertainty. And when the outcome of a study has inconclusive, unexpected, or contradicting results, there needs to be a way to convey that information to the public when necessary.
Without confusing them or undermining their trust in science.
It's a tricky balance.
For sure.
So let's pose a question or two to our listeners.
Sounds good to me.
Well, for starters, how do you feel about storytelling, aka narrative persuasion, in the communication of science? If you're a scientist, would you feel comfortable learning and then using this technique? If you're a community member, do you think this tactic would better capture your attention?
Please let us know your thoughts. We'd really like to hear both sides of the story on this one. The Twitter handle is at ISGPForum, and the hashtags today are hashtag ISGPForum and hashtag SciComm. That's SciComm.
Before we sign off today, I feel that it's our duty to elaborate on the importance of the science communication topic we've discussed today. It may not seem as pressing as infectious disease or food safety, but it's pretty darn important.
You're right, Barb. In fact, a lot of the topics we discuss on the forum have scientific support, but they lack the public support.
And without public support, it's awfully difficult to get policymakers to cooperate. Ergo, if you have no public support, you cannot have change. So, how do you gain that public support? Effective communication measures.
I think the importance can also be conveyed by this little fact. The concept of the forum was actually developed during the science communication workshop at which Ms. Neely's paper was debated.
Ms. Neely's debate, as well as the other two debates at this conference, inspired the Institute on Science for Global Policy to become a more vocal player in the world of SciComm.
And we're proud to be a part of that growing community of science communicators across the globe.
On that note, it's your turn to contribute to the conversation. We'll be looking for your comments on Twitter and on our Facebook page, which you can find by searching ISGP's The Forum.
Well, we hope you've been inspired to continue socializing with science today. We look forward to chatting with you next time, right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.